You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And our opening music, that was Hot Texas, performed and written by the Hot Texas Swing Band. And if you're seeing double, it's because part of the story tonight has to do with twins. Who is our guest tonight?
Our guest, special guest and friend, J.R. Sanders.
Yes, and here he is in the house.
Hey,
how you doing? We're so delighted that you're joining us. You're joining us from California. What's your weather like there right now?
It's 100-ish today.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it is right here.
Welcome to Albuquerque. It's so much fun to see you. JR has been, we've known each other, I don't even know how many years, JR, right? I think we first met when your first book, Littlest Wrangler, perhaps came out, and you were with us at an early Buckaroo Bookshop, if not the first year, pretty much right from the beginning.
Yep.
And then you were with us on the writer's block every time a new book came out. We always looked forward. Usually you were able to actually be in the studio the years that we were live there in the studio. And it just feels like, you know, you and your lovely wife, Rose, you're just like best buds of ours.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think Jim has a little intro here.
We have a short bio. You're going to fill in all the gaps, JR.
Okay.
J.R. Sanders is a native Midwesterner and longtime denizen of the L.A. suburbs. His first Nate Ross novel, Stardust Trail, a detective story set among the B-Western film productions of the 1930s Hollywood. It was a 2021 Spur Award finalist for Best Historical Novel and 2021 Silver Falcon Award finalist for Best Investigator. Dead Bang Fall. The second Nate Ross novel is currently a 2023 Seamus Award finalist for Best Original PI Paperback. Bring the Night, the third in the series, was released in April 2023 by Level Best Books Historia.
Oh,
welcome.
What a story.
Glad to be here.
Oh, so delightful. So we'd love you to tell us a little bit more about yourself and maybe when and how you found writing as something you wanted to do.
Yeah. Writing's something I've done my whole life. You know, I was always fascinated with it. I actually wrote my first book when I was 7 years old.
All right.
You know, it was hand-drawn and cardstock taped together with it. White adhesive medical tape, and it was just as horrible as you would imagine it is. I actually still have it, but it's something I've always done, always enjoyed, and I've done it, you know, only full time for about the last 30 years, and started off as a nonfiction writer, writing mainly about the Old West, and then have just in the last few years gotten into fiction, writing crime novels.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of crime novels, Dead Bang Fall, congratulations. It's been nominated for the Killer Nashville Reader's Choice Award and we voted.
Thank you.
And I will put up later tonight on our Rendezvous with a Writer Facebook page and my personal page, we'll go ahead and pull that link over so that people have a chance to vote. That's very fun. What a list of books there. Oh, yeah. My goodness.
A lot of great writers. Really good.
So did you submit your book to that particular readers contest, or how'd that come about?
It's been submitted for the Silver Falchion Award through Killer Nashville. And I'm not actually clear on how they select the Reader's Choice books, because it's not all the books, or it doesn't appear to be all the books that are in the running for Silver Falchion. But apparently, internally, they select X number of books to put on the Reader's Choice list.
That is just so interesting, all the different things that writers, you know, all of the different awards that are out there. And then I also saw that your short story Dead Even is being featured in an upcoming anthology. What a great title, Killing Time in San Diego. Tell us a little bit about how that came about.
That's BoucherCon, the big mystery writer fan convention that takes place every year, is being held in San Diego this year. And every year they do an anthology, and they solicit stories from mystery writers, not necessarily people who are coming to BoucherCon, but and so the call went out this year, and I had not written short stories before. It's kind of embarrassing to admit. I think the last short story I wrote, I was probably in the eighth grade. Never written one for publication, but I thought, well, you know, why not stretch a little, try something different? And to my surprise, they accepted the story.
Very good. You know, just want to ask a question before we get into actually these crime novels there. You have a little background in law enforcement, right, JR?
Yeah, I was a police officer for about 14 years, 14 and a half years. Did a brief stint in my wild, reckless young years as a private investigator. Although I wish that was half as cool as it sounded. No fist fights, no car chases, got knocked out with a sap.
No drinking in the bars. No drinking in bars.
Well, I have to say one thing. Somewhere along the line, you picked up all this cool lingo.
When you were talking, and you mentioned, of course, you hadn't really written short stories, but you have written for magazines. You've written quite a few nonfiction articles for magazines. And then this wonderful book, we will talk about it for a moment, Some Gave All, oh my goodness, Some Gave All, Forgotten Old West Lawmen Who Died With Their Boots On. Will you take a moment, JR, and kind of tell us how this, what inspired you? How did this come about?
It was back, I was working on a magazine article, and I don't even remember what the article was or what the information was I was looking for. But I was looking through copies of Texas newspapers from the mid-1880s, and I found the item that I was looking for, and a couple columns over was a story, an account of a U.S. Marshal who had just been killed on a train while he was transporting prisoners to the federal penitentiary. And I thought at the time that I was pretty well versed in Old West lawmen, gunfighters, that sort of thing, but I had never heard of this incident or this person, so it kind of fascinated me. My first thought was, here's another magazine article. Here's, you know, a great story. And then as I researched a little more and thought about it more, I thought, you know, there are probably a lot of these stories out there. Lawmen who, you know, whose careers were just as colorful as Wyatt Earp or Wild Bill Hickok or any of the, you know, the icons that we think about when we think about Old West lawmen. There were probably a lot of guys who fit that same mold, but nobody remembers them because they were killed in the line of duty. You know, died early in their careers, were buried, forgotten about, sort of swept into history's dustbin. And that just seemed like a shame to me. It seemed like, you know, they should be remembered. Mm-hmm. And so I started doing a lot of digging and just came up with account after account of mm-hmm. people that I had never heard of, cases mm-hmm. that I had never heard of, too many to put in one book. And so I had to narrow down and tried to pick ones that I thought were particularly interesting or that illustrated some facet of law enforcement that maybe people, the modern readers, could relate to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have, it looks as a reminder, it looks like you have 10 chapters. One of them mm-hmm. Highlights a number of people. I'm not really remembering, but Sheriff Daniel Carlisle Cameron and a bunch of other people. July 19th, 1898.
You've got
six.
Mm-hmm. County, California.
Uh-huh.
Still the greatest single law enforcement loss of life in one incident, I believe, in the mm-hmm. entire country.
July 19th. What's today?
Yeah.
1898. This was a wonderful book. I remember reading it as soon as it came out. And then I know we saw you at least with one presentation where you also had fabulous slides, probably a PowerPoint with images of so many of the men that you write about here. So once again, I'm just going to hold this up because this is, if you're at all interested in Western history, law and order in the West, some gave all, this is a terrific book. And I think you had shared that that same story that first got you to this book kind of inspired the first Nate Ross novel. Is that right?
It did. You know, that story stuck with me, and it's such a colorful, you know, just blood and thunder Old West story. So when I was mapping out the story for Stardust Trail, I knew there was going to be an Old West backstory, an Old West component. And so I adapted that story, fictionalized it pretty heavily, but used the bones of it as the backstory to Stardust Trail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Joe, when you're doing your research, where did you find the information? In particular, you were reading in a newspaper, in an old newspaper. Where did you go to get that information? Did you go to libraries?
Libraries, you can do a lot of it online now. I've got a subscription to newspapers.com.
It's
a lot of newspapers from all over the country, from going back to the, I think they've got them back to the 18th century now. Great resource.
It's amazing that information is out there, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
Do you remember the days going by when you were reading a newspaper? And remember when they had microfiche?
Microfiche.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That drove you crazy trying to find something. I don't know anything available.
now, that's what I did back in the private eye days, mostly.
Okay.
Going through dusty old court records and microfiche. nothing very life-threatening.
So let's talk about Nate Ross.
Okay.
So Nate Ross is this very cool, hard, some might say he lives in a hard-boiled sort of detective world, California, Los Angeles, and we meet him first in 1938. Tell us a little bit about this character and how you met. How did you two find each other?
Well, I've always been fascinated with that period, particularly in Los Angeles. And I've read all the classic, you know, Raymond Chandler, you know, Dashiell Hammett, James M. Cain, stuff that was written in that period, all the kind of the hard-boiled, you know, masters. And I wanted to do something along the same lines, but I wanted the character to be a little bit different, not the stereotypical lone wolf who does everything on his own, never asks for anyone's help. And I wanted him to be a little bit, when you write in this period and this genre, there's always comparison with with Chandler and Hammett. It's just inevitable. I wanted him to be a little more tarnished than Philip Marlowe, a little harder edged, but not quite Sam Spade. Sam Spade had sort of, you know, he was a good detective, but he had, his morals were pretty questionable. Mm-hmm. Kind of alley cat morals, I call them. Mm-hmm. So I wanted somebody that was kind of in between those two, somewhere in the middle. And Nate, in the early drafts, Nate was a former Pasadena police officer.
Ah.
And then along the way, that shifted, and he became a Los Angeles police officer. And originally, he was going to have grown up in Pasadena. But then when I got into incorporating the making of Stagecoach, John Ford's Western, into Stardust Trail, that inevitably brought John Wayne into the story. I didn't want him to be a gratuitous character in the book, but I felt sort of obligated to have him at least make an appearance. And it occurred to me, as I was thinking how to do that, that he and Nate Ross would have been about the same age. Mm-hmm. And so, as it's written in Stardust Trail, the two of them went to high school together in Glendale.
Yeah, it's so fun.
I mean, these are serious stories. I mean, these are not comedies per se, but there's so much that you write. I know I'm hearing some microphone feedback, and I'm not sure if that's us. I apologize for that if you're hearing it too. But you know, the books are just, and if you live in the Los Angeles area, many of the landmarks and things will be familiar.
A lot of it's still there.
Yeah, and if you don't live there, some of them will be famous. You'll recognize. Do you have to do a lot of research, JR, to make sure that you're staying accurate with the what you're writing about?
I do. I have some legal books from the period and books on detective procedures, investigative procedures, that sort of thing, to be sure that what I'm doing lines up with how those things were done in the 30s. And then geography is a big deal. When you're writing about LA, you know, if you don't get the geography right, you're going to hear about it. So I've got a map book, kind of an early version of the Thomas Guide, if you remember those.
I do remember those. I never understood how to use the Thomas Guide when we moved to LA. Everybody used it and told you it never made sense to me at all.
Yeah. Well, nowadays nobody would know how to use one because everyone has GPS.
Yeah.
But so I've got a period version of similar to a Thomas Guide. So I check streets and addresses and that sort of thing, where public buildings are in relation to other landmarks. I've got road maps from the period that I depend on. Even a map of the streetcar, Pacific Electric car system, the red car, and the yellow
car. I know you must have a question. I'm sure you have a question for JR.
You know, he actually works very well with the chief of detectives, yeah, by the name of Quinnen. What's that guy like? Is he pretty straightforward guy?
He is. He's he doesn't come off that way. You know, and he's a guy who'll bend the rules. He's definitely a product of his time. And in the first book, he's not very sympathetic to Nate. In fact, he's pretty antagonistic. Nate's got this history with the Sheriff's Department and LAPD because he ended up testifying against some crooked cops who went to prison. And so none of the police from either agency in LA particularly like Nate. He's pretty much a pariah. And so that's when he first meets Queen, and that's how he's dealt with. But along the way, they've developed kind of a grudging respect for each other. They're not quite friends, but they're not quite enemies either.
Right. We We are going to take a very short break. We're going to show our listeners and our viewers where they can get your books off of our Out West Shop bookshop page. And when we come back, we'll be talking about Bring in the Night. No, Bring in Night. Bring in Night. Bring on Night.
Bring the Night.
Bring the Night.
Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com. Find books and CDs on the menu. Choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Special guest, J.R. Sanders. And we're talking about his book, Bring the Night.
Bring the Night. Bring the Night is the correct title.
You know, JR, this first paragraph you started this book off with, I think it's just great. So I'm going to read it here. Suicide was all the rage in L.A. the summer of 39. It wasn't the heat. We had a mild summer as Southern California summers go. Still, shopkeepers couldn't keep white paper and rat poison on the shelves. Hardware stores that are run on hemp rope and cheap pistols. And no fewer than five Angelinos so far have made the short hop across the Pasadena line to do gainers off the Colorado Bridge. And we know that bridge.
We know that bridge. We lived really close to that bridge. Oh my gosh, that's the opening. If that doesn't grab you as a reader,
that's perfect, isn't it?
I don't know. I don't know what will. And as we read this book, sometimes we were in the same room, and Jim would say, wait, did you hear? Did you read? And I say, no, I'm not there yet. And he said, but you have to hear this. And so we had just a great time with the prose of this. Of this story, and we would really encourage our listeners and our viewers. This is the third in the series. JR, you know what it is to write a series, and of course it can stand alone. Tell us a little bit about the storyline, and maybe who are some of the characters that we see again from the previous books.
Okay, well, the storyline, it begins Nate's killing time on an off day, on a Sunday, just doing busy work in his office and reading the newspaper. And he reads about this latest suicide that's happened and is reflecting about all the suicides that have happened during the summer. When two characters walk in, brother and sister, pair of twins, and oddly enough, they want to talk to Nate about the very case he's just been reading about in the newspaper. Their father's suicide, which they claim was not suicide, was murder. Nate's a little skeptical of that, and he's skeptical of the twins. They don't quite ring right to him. But he's sort of intrigued by the fact that they walked in with this story right after he read about it in the newspaper. So he agrees to take on the case and immediately finds out that the evidence doesn't really add up to suicide. But for some reason, the police don't really care. They seem to have just swept the whole thing under the rug and moved on to the next case. So he's bothered by that. And digs deeper and deeper and ends up on this dark path that takes him into dirty city politics and murder and some deep, dark family secrets. And the more loose threads he pulls out, the more things kind of start to completely unravel.
Mm-hmm. On the same page as that first paragraph, the bottom paragraph describes what he is reading about with this suicide. And we just have to share this. except that he'd chosen the 4th of July, I didn't see anything too imaginative or noteworthy in what seemed like just another run-of-the-mill Dutch act. The guy worked for a downtown travel bureau. The milkman who found him early Friday morning behind the wheel of a Buick coupe with its engine barely still running in the closed garage of his modest Highland Park home, Cecil J. Witkenack, 43, had booked his own permanent bon voyage and motored straight to his destination without ever putting the car in gear. He was dressed in a white linen suit, his tie was royal blue, and his lips were cherry red. It was a Yankee Doodle Dandy way to go.
How do you come up with all that?
It just flows, right, JR? Somehow it just flows. Oh, my goodness. Well, I know that there's another description that Jim wants to read. If you don't mind, I think it's really fun for listeners to have a chance to actually, you know, kind of hear the wonderful prose. And this is written in the first person, so this is Nate Ross. This is Nate Ross talking. All right, so Jim is going to read. This is the description of the bench sitter.
Isn't it? And this is a very special character, the dog with no name. But the bench sitter looks like the usual scratch house bum you see lazing around in any public park on any day that ends with Y. Every day of the week.
Any day that ends with Y. I have to remember that. Yeah. Yes.
You want me to read more?
Well, tell us about the dog. Tell us about the dog character, JR.
Well, Nate encounters this dog. He's taking a walk through the park to kind of clear its head and go over the case that he's working on. And just sees a stray dog approaching a guy sitting, you know, drinking out of his paper bag and eating a sandwich on a park bench. And he's just idly watching and notices that the guy is being abusive to the dog, and that doesn't sit right with Nate. So he thinks about intervening, but then the dog seems to kind of be sticking up for himself. But then when the scratch house bum takes it a step further, Nate steps in and kind of rescues the dog from this guy. And then he has to find a way to get away from the dog. He doesn't want the dog to follow him across the busy street. But sure enough, you know, a little bit of a spoiler, but the dog shows up later in the story and ends up playing his part and what goes on after.
Yeah, he plays a big part, actually.
He does. So, he plays a big part. I know, we don't want to do a lot of spoiler alerts. But like any good mystery, detective mystery, there are twists and turns. And tell us, when you're writing a mystery, JR, as a mystery writer, do you already pretty much have in your mind the whole storyline? You know what false evidence you're going to give us or false clues, you know? Tell us a little bit about that process of writing a mystery.
Sometimes I know and sometimes I don't. When I sit down to plot one out, it's pretty much just the broad strokes that I start with. I generally know how it's going to start and how it's going to resolve. But the things in between, I'm definitely not a plotter. I'm a pantser. I write by the seat of my pants. And so a lot of it just develops as I get deeper and deeper into things and see how I have to craft, you know, this scene or bring in this plot element or write myself out of the corner that I've ripped myself into. And I had a thought here.
That's all right. Do you ever find that you have an idea and then you go realize in order to use that, you'll have to go back and plant enough. I don't know if plant's the right word, but you'll have to include somehow to make them. You have to do a connector.
Yeah, yeah, that happens a lot, and it's just an odd process, or for me anyway. Maybe if I were a plotter, it would be simpler. But Stardust Trail, for instance, when I rode it, I didn't know until I was probably 80% done with it who the killer was.
Interesting.
Okay.
Interesting.
And so once I decided on who the killer was, then I did have to go back and rearrange some things earlier to make that.
As you're working with your characters, sometimes they kind of get a life of their own and go off in a way you didn't expect them to.
Definitely. Nate does that all the time. Nate and are doing things that just like, where did that even come from?
Does he whisper to you?
It seems like it.
Yeah. Do you, today with all the CSI shows and things, you know, we hear a lot about different forensics and we hear DNA is, you know, a big topic. And of course, here we're talking of an earlier time, 38, 39. Fingerprints seem to be kind of one of the main important evidence trails. And fingerprints make a very, I don't think it's a spoiler alert, but if you would like to maybe, and also talk a little bit about Mikey and fingerprints.
Fingerprints do play a big part in the story this time, or even the lack of fingerprints. And it was still a pretty early science at the time, but a lot of the basic stuff the police do when they're taking fingerprints at a crime scene was very similar to what goes on today. Some of the techniques are different. Some of the materials now are different. But the basic, you know, dusting for prints that still goes on was how they were doing it then. Mm-hmm. Mikey was he was kind of a fun character. He made an appearance in the beginning of Stardust Trail, and he was sort of, at the time, I thought, just a one-off character. But when I started laying out this book, I thought, why not bring Mikey back? He and Nate had sort of bonded, and it just seemed logical that Nate would try to help him out as he got a little older, finished school, you know, young man looking for a career. And so in this story, Mikey is studying criminal science. He's taking night classes, and he's planning to go to Berkeley, which was the premier criminal science school at the time. And so Nate uses him as his fingerprint guy, as his sort of his, you know, early CSI guy. And Mikey is still very much a kid, so he's kind of an eager beaver, and he wants to do more than just the boring stuff, as he sees it, of taking fingerprints and stuff. He wants to get involved in some of the dangerous, you know, what he thinks is glamorous.
Mm-hmm. And we learn that it is possible to not have fingerprints.
Yeah. And there was actually a Swiss doctor doing research on it in the 1930s. And they had identified this strange physical anomaly where people were born with completely smooth fingertips, no ridges at all. And apparently they're still not quite sure what to make of it. They've only identified a few families that have had it. They're not even sure, apparently, that it's a genetic thing. Mm. It's still, to this day, it's still kind of a mystery.
It's so interesting. It's just so interesting. And that's another kind of it's not a spoiler alert, but it's an aha. You're like, you're reading along.
It's important in the story.
What?
It plays. Yeah.
Do you want to ask about the title?
About the title?
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the title that I screwed up earlier.
Bring the Night. Well, it's actually a line from a phrase from an old English hymn that was written in the 1700s called "Awake Ye Saints." I actually have a copy of the
right there
music there for it. And it's one of the lyrics in the song, and this hymn plays a part in the story as well. But that phrase, bring the night, just seemed to, it seemed to sort of encapsulate, you know, this is a much darker book than the two that came before it. Mm-hmm. So that phrase just stuck with me, and it seemed to kind of capture the essence of the book.
Mm-hmm. And it's, as you said, from the sheet music, it's from a hymn. And one of the characters in the book has several hymnals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a favorite of hers. And I'm just going to really quickly, because I think it's so interesting to read where it comes from. And as a reader, I'm always trying to figure out, where's that title? Where's that title? How is that title gonna, going to connect to the story? So here's the familiar words. Ye wheels of nature, speed your course. Ye mortal powers, decay. Fast as you bring the night of death, you bring eternal day. Really like it. I'd like to hear it. I'd like to hear it. I'm gonna have to go. I'm gonna have to go find to be able to hear the music and hear how it sounds. Yeah. Let's see. I'm just looking at our time. Let's see. We've got a little bit of time here. Oh, do you when you're developing your characters, do you develop like backstories for them? Or do you keep notes so you remember who you killed off? You don't bring them back, that kind of thing.
I do. Yeah, I've got a notebook where I jot down, kind of the pertinent facts, because I may need to know, you know, two books later what color Nate Ross's eyes are, or how tall he is, or where he lives, that kind of thing. I don't do real deep character biographies or anything. I sort of sketch them and then just develop them as I go.
Yeah. We're going to go ahead and take another short break. We're going to hear from our sponsor, Out West Shop, and we'll be right back with J.R. Sanders. Stay tuned.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer, with special guest J.R. Sanders.
And we've been talking about his books, Stardust Trail, and please hold up the one that you have. It somehow we've put, yes, I know we have it, JR, but I couldn't find it today. I don't know why. And today we're talking about Bring the Night. And you know, you also gifted us with Emily's Gift.
Mm.
Would you talk a little bit about this book?
That was my wife's inspiration, and she helped me write it, and just kind of a fun little passion project, I guess you'd call it. We wanted to do a Christmas book and a kid's book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Will there be more? Will you do a Christmas book every year or every other year or something like that?
Doubtful.
Do you have a favorite place that you like to write?
Just my office at home. I'm sitting right now at my antique 1910 desk. And it's where I do my best work, I guess, where my mind kind of opens up and do what I need to do.
I know you have some process kind of questions.
I just want to tell our listeners and readers out there that, you know, we work real hard not to have any spoiler alerts, but their bodies dropping left and right.
not nearly as many as the last book.
And there are some endearing characters that return. Dusty is, of course, one of our favorites who makes an appearance in this book as well.
And I'll give you a spoiler alert there. Dusty, no matter how many Nate Ross books there are, Dusty will never, ever die. Because my wife, Rose, that's the only thing she's ever threatened me with divorce over. And I
hope to be. He's a serious character.
Yeah,
for her.
Yeah, he's fun. He's very fun.
He may get beat up. He may get knocked around a little bit, but he's never going to die.
We talked about you kind of touched on writing yourself into a corner. Do you ever come up with writer's block, you know, when you're working on your books?
I'd hesitate to ever call it writer's block. You know, there are times when you sort of get stuck on something. And with me, it's usually some trivial thing, some little factoid that will hang me up. But generally, you know, you just keep going. When I get stuck on something like that, I just drop it and I write something completely different. I'll do scenes out of sequence. Or this entire book, actually, Bring the Night, I wrote kind of in the way that they make movies, scenes out of sequence. And a lot of it was because of that, because there were so many weird factors, that things that I hadn't dealt with before that went into it, that it was just easier for me to break it down into segments and write it that way.
Interesting. That's so interesting. Do you like to write with any kind of music in the background, or do you write, you like need silence?
Yeah, silence. And my dogs very seldom cooperate with that, but.
Yeah. And I know that you are, I believe, still a member of Western Writers of America. What kind of benefit do you find being connected to writers groups?
It's great, just for networking, just for sharing stories, cross promotion. You know, writers, particularly in the Western Writers of America, that's probably the most supportive group of people I've ever encountered. They're really, you know, looking out for each other. So there's a lot of value to belonging to a writer's group. Just that community, people that understand, you know, what you're going through. You can't talk to, you know, the person at the grocery store or your barber or somebody about writing, because people that don't do it just don't really understand, you know, the struggles that you're dealing with. It seems, you know, to the outsider a whole lot easier than it is sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we just came back from our first going as members to the very first convention that we've been to. And, you know, it was so wonderful. You hear people, oftentimes they knew each other and they were excited to see each other. Mm-hmm. But there was such camaraderie. You would imagine they have their Spur Awards. It's the kind of thing you might imagine there could be competition. Mm-hmm. But everyone was just, what are you working on now? And, oh, and I read and I saw and congratulations. And it was really so, so very warm and inviting and people so eager to share about what they were working on. And also to congratulate, they were reading each other's, you know, books.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought that was just really a very, very, very special.
It was due to WWA that Craig Johnson read Bring the Night and gave me a very nice blurb for it, which I greatly appreciated.
Yes, he sure did. So let's see, what are you working on next, JR? What's coming up?
Nate Ross number 4.
Number 4.
Yet to be titled. But now that's my big project now.
Are we still in like 1939? Is it kind of, does he finish this case, Bring the Night, and starts, you know, clients walk in like 2 days later and he's at it again?
Yeah. You know, because I'm inching up on the World War II years, I've got to kind of compact these things or at some point end up dealing with the war.
Right.
And so the book that I'm working on is still set in 39, and I'm contracted to do 2 more beyond that. And so whether those will go into the war years or not, I can't really say yet.
Mm-hmm. Jim, I know, has he always pulls a couple of quotes together, and he has a couple to share.
I do. I want to ask a fun question. Oh. You got a reporter, Angie Underwood.
Angie Underwood, yeah.
Did you name her after a typewriter?
Actually, she's a real person. She okay. worked for the Herald Express back in the day, and was the first.
Is that right?
I believe the first woman in the country, certainly the first one in LA, anyway, to end up being the chief editor of the newspaper.
Oh my gosh! Wow, what a great story!
She was very famous in her day. She reported on the Black Dahlia, and
Yeah,
if you look. You know, look up the newspaper files on Black Dahlia, and you'll see a lot of Aggie Underwood articles.
Oh, how interesting. Well, I know there were a couple of other real characters that you put in the book as well. The mayor, I think, was the real mayor at the time.
The mayor, the police chief, yeah, the district attorney.
Yeah, yeah. What did you pull together, Jim? Let's hear, let's let JR hear what you chose.
Well, we have our hero here. Nate, he's talking to the coroner, and I like his expressions. Although we've fallen out of touch, in no time we were shooting the lemons like old pals.
Shooting the lemons like old pals. Like there'd been no water under the bridge.
And then we had one of our characters who was actually a kind of partner with our victim here, our suicide fellow in the beginning. For the way Charlie Dubek had been a wrong guy, he was right about one thing. Gone didn't mean you didn't still have reach. So, that's pretty good.
JR, where can people find you and follow you and such?
The easiest place is jrsanders.com. My website, and you can find all the social media links on there to Instagram and Facebook.
And you really need to go to JR's Facebook page, because if you need a little bit of a laugh, a smile, a guffaw, a chuckle, something you would like to share to your page, because you know it will bring everybody in your life something fun, you got to check out JR's. Is that your personal page or your author page, JR? That's your personal page? Comic a day.
A little bit of both, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't see them every day. I have to go and catch up. And it's like, Jim, look at this one. Well, we're going to thank you for being with us. Don't go away. Next week, we have a full house. Author Peggy Chambers joins us as a co-host. She'll be with us, but she'll be kind of running the show, and she's invited a good author friend of hers. And I just started reading. You would probably enjoy these, JR. This is a mystery series, the Father Anthony Saville mystery series. And the first one is called The Golden Fistula, and the second is The Marble Finger. And these are written by the Reverend Dr. John F. Toltz.
Wow.
And they are really good. So if you like Father Brown, or you like the Mitford series or something like that, you'll really enjoy these. And we look forward to having them with us next week. And we want to just take a moment and say thank you to all of you that have come along with us tonight. You might be listening live, or maybe you're picking this up as a podcast. We really appreciate you tuning in. And thank you, JR.
Thank you, JR.
Thank you
to Sam Hassan and LA Talk Radio for everything that you do for this show. And Alex Dormont and the Hot Texas Swing Band. And I think on behalf of
Jim and Bobby Bell, it's always a good day out west.
We'll see you next week.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell.